And this guy Chris was supposed to speak, and then they come up with this guy Roy, and it's like, I met him when he first came in the door, and he's the first addict that I've met that has the same name as me. And I thought I was really alone, and now it's really neat and appropriate that I'm able to be here and get to hear this gentleman's message. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce the speaker, Roy.
I'm an addict, and my name is Roy.
Hello.
And it's good to be here. I'm glad I didn't have a whole lot of time to think about this. You know, I was standing in the other doorway, waiting to go into the other room, and a girl came up and asked me if I would, and I was torn. You know, my girlfriend's sharing in the other room, and I wanted to support her, and that's why a lot of us had come up from Connecticut, just because she was sharing and we wanted to hear her. So I was torn. You know, this fellowship has taught me I shouldn't say no. And so I asked her what she thought. You know, I wanted to put it off on somebody else. You made the decision for me. And she said, go ahead. So here I am. You know, I don't want to get into a real long story about me. I'm an addict, and the first time I said that was the first time I got a little taste of humility. I think I knew it for a long time. I just didn't want to face it. And I guess that's what being humble is about. It's about facing yourself. You know, my sponsor used to put it, it's being right-sized. You know, and I used to think that I was bigger than life. You know, and my addiction took me through places where I thought I was all-powerful. I was fearless for a long time, you know, and I know today that had a lot to do with my upbringing. You know, I came from a normal family from my area. You know, that would not be normal in a lot of areas. You know, there was a lot of drinking. You know, I was the first generation born in the United States. And it was like a way of life for my family. You know, that's what they did. When they weren't working, they were partying. And speaking all sorts of different languages. You know, one side of the family was French. The other side of the family was Swedish. And then we had the in-laws. They were all English. And growing up, I could speak three different languages. And today, I can't understand anything but English. And I felt real bad about that here. I studied French for 8 years, and when the last of my relatives died, I was about 10, and I lost the French language. You know, I didn't pursue it in school anymore. I didn't speak it at all, and I came up here, and I'm hearing it all over the place, and I'm lucky if I can pick one word out of a sentence. And it gave me something to strive for, you know, with the other convention coming up in Canada in May. I set a goal for myself. I'll be able to speak it by then. Again, I hope. You know, I'm going to try. You know, so I don't have to wear those headphones. It bothered me last night. You know, because I'd have to take them on and off all the time. For me, I picked up intentionally. I was 10 years old. It was the first thing that made me intentionally pick up was a death in my family. I had one stable uncle, and I idolized him. He was into sports. He was in the military at the time and doing real well there. And he was solid. I could go and I could ask him something. I could talk to him about something. He would take the time to listen to me, and nobody else seemed to. You know, my mother was too busy working. My father was too busy working. And I'm the oldest in my family. I've got three younger brothers. And I got stuck a lot as a kid. You know, and this uncle used to unstick me. I could talk to him. I could tell him how I feel. They didn't laugh at me. They didn't tell me I shouldn't feel that way. And my mother and father were great. You shouldn't feel that way. don't talk about it. And this guy used to put me back on course, year after year, it seemed. And when I was 10, he was murdered, and I was shook up, and I couldn't talk about it. You know, nobody wanted to hear from me. You know, everybody was too busy with all the other things that were going on. And when they had the after-funeral celebration, as I used to call them, when everybody would get drunk, you know, I grabbed a bottle of scotch and I went over to the playground. And I got blotto. Because I saw everybody else doing it. And I didn't want to feel, and that's what it seemed like they were doing. They were doing this so they wouldn't feel. And that's what I wanted. You know, I went over there, I started drinking and crying, and then I stopped feeling. And I liked that one part of it. I didn't like the fact I was sick for 3 days afterwards. But I liked that little space I got where I didn't feel the pain and the hurt. And by getting that little bit of relief at that point in time, it started the ball rolling for me. And you know, I heard the speaker say it last night, that my drug of choice was more. I went through the whole list. You know, when one stopped working, I went to the next one. And by the time I was a sophomore in high school, I tried about everything. You know, I left high school in my senior year because I got busted twice in one day. And I didn't want to wait for the police to come. You know, the first time I got a little reprimand and I was told I was being suspended. The second time they were going to throw the book at me and I threw my books at them. And I said, I'm out of here. I'm finished. And about 3 months later, I went into the service myself. You know, I was at that age at that time. You got your little draft notice. You said, we're going to send you off to sunny Southeast Asia. So I joined the Navy. Again, my uncle came back to me. He made a career out of being in the Navy. And being that I really idolized the guy, I thought, well, maybe that's what I need. So I joined the Navy. And I signed myself up to do all the things that he was doing. You know, I wanted to be him. I didn't want to be me. I wanted to be him. The problem was they took me, the addict, with me. You know? And for a couple of years, I did real well. I straightened up my act a little bit. I started asking how. You know, because I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to do a lot of things. And I was scared a lot. You know, I volunteered for submarine duty. You should have seen me the first time that thing went underwater. You want to see somebody shake. I was a physical and emotional wreck. But, you know, I got through it. You know, because I saw everybody else was just like, it's no big deal. We do it all the time. Yeah. And it took me around the world. You know, I got to see places I probably never would have seen. But as I got comfortable with it, I let my addiction come back into the picture. I started to use more and more. We'd go out for 3 months at a clip, and you couldn't go in there with cases of beer and drugs and smuggle them on the ship and hide them anywhere. So I'd have to get real cunning and figure out what I could do that would last me 3 months at sea and not get caught. And I came close to getting caught many times. And I didn't think about the jeopardy I was putting other members of my crew into. I was a driver. Here I am driving a submarine, whacked. And I never gave it a second thought until I came to this fellowship of how I didn't care about the other people whose lives actually depended on what I was doing. You know, I had a whole crew of people who depended on me paying attention and doing my job. And eventually my addiction caught up with me in the service. I'd swapped rates for convenience. You know, I became a storekeeper. I liked smuggling and the black market. And I got caught. And the only thing that kept me from really getting raked over the coals was I had a lot of good time. And it saved me from a dishonorable discharge and a whole lot of other things. You know, they asked me to leave, and I did. And I got my first stint in jail. And I'd gone into daily lockups, you know, for being drunk driving and stuff like that. But I ended up court-martialed and ended up in what they call the Red Line Brig for 7 months. And that gave me a real taste of something I didn't want to do again. You know, the door shut was very final. You know, that clank. Asking permission to do anything. You know, you weren't allowed to do anything without permission. And I didn't like it. So when I left the service, I went back to what I had done before. You know, I bought myself a new motorcycle. I let my hair grow. And as you can tell, hair is one of my favorite things. I like to let it grow. It's me. You know, I've been on the other side. I tried the three-piece suit and looking respectable. And I said, who am I trying to kid? You know, this isn't me. You know, and I figured everybody knew that. You'd look at me in that setting, and somebody said, that guy's a phony. You know? And so I ended up changing jobs. You know, I went in and out of marriage, and I got married as an addict, and it was convenient. She was rich. I thought that would fix me. You know, her family had everything, and I had pretty much nothing. And it didn't last. You know, I've got two children. You know, one of them I've never seen. You know, the son that I had when I was in the service, the girl wanted to have it, I didn't. He's 19, and I have a daughter from my marriage who's going to be 10 next week, and I don't have a relationship with either. You know, I lost the ability to have a relationship with my daughter because of my addiction, and when I got divorced, I lost everything, custody, visitation, parental rights, the whole works, because I was an addict and I didn't care. And I waited until it was too long, and that's what hurt most, is I waited too long. You know, at one point I could have done something. You know, I could have fought for my rights, and I chose not to, and it was a mistake. I know it today. I made a big mistake there. But you know, what helped me was my sponsor saying, you know, no matter what, you're her father, and if she wants to find you, she will. And if she wants to talk to you, you can let her. And that was the last thing I told her when I last saw her. But if she ever needed to talk to me, she could. And through recovery and coming into this fellowship, I'm easy to find. You know, I don't have to change my phone number. I'm not changing my address monthly. You know, I'm me. You know, and I'm being more responsible today. And sometimes it's real hard. You know, in the beginning it was very, very hard to ask for help because I thought I knew all the answers. You know, and I was very lucky in the beginning. I had a sponsor who had a lot of time and had a lot of what I wanted, and he would sit me down and talk to me like my uncle used to. He didn't go around the fence. He went straight to what he wanted to say. You know, he didn't handle me with kid gloves. You know, he didn't tell me what to do. You know, he was very, very cautious, I guess, about that. He made it sound like this would be good for you if you think you'd like to try it. And that was good for me, because in the beginning, if you told me what to do, I would do the opposite. You know, the addict in me was always like that. But he just taught me to respect what he had to say. I didn't have to like it. My responsibility, the only thing he told me was a must for me and him, was I had to listen to him. That was it. That was my responsibility, to listen. And what I did after that was up to me. That was my choice. And that helped me a lot. You know, a lot of things he told me I didn't want to sit and listen to. But I kept telling myself I had to. You know, because I didn't know how to run my life. And that was hard to admit. You know? We went to New Year's one year to watch the ball come down in the city. And I'd never done that in addiction or recovery. And he told me at the time I was clean about 3 years. He says, you know, when I first met you, you could have taken a ball. And you see all those thousands of people out there. You could have thrown that ball, and whoever picked it up could have run your life better than you. And he was right. Because I didn't know anything about living. I knew a lot about surviving. I've learned that addicts can survive anywhere. You know, if you drop an addict in the middle of the desert, he'd survive. He'd find some way to survive. And in recovery, I really had no idea what to do. I hadn't had a job that lasted more than a year in my life. I'd get tired of it, or they'd get tired of me. And in recovery, work's been easy. The hardest part for me was learning to show up for it, being responsible enough to get up on time. And, you know, today I look forward to going to work. And a lot of people look at me and say, you're nuts. Who wants to work? And I like what I do. I'm outside all year round. And I get a sense of joy out of what I make. And I tell my sponsees all the time, if you don't like what you're doing for a job, start looking for something you want to do. You know, I believe since you got to spend so much time in your life working, you better like what you're doing. Or get something out of it besides money. I've learned that it's not about money. You know, money was my other addiction. I gambled for years. I haven't gambled in recovery, other than the lottery ticket once in a while. You know, when it gets above $4 million, I'll spend a dollar. You know, I won't go down there and buy 100 of them, but I'll go try one and figure if I win, it's my higher power's will for me today. You know, I know that money won't fix me. When I have too much of it, I spend too much of it. I know that the outside things don't make the inside feel better. You know, I learned that the hard way, too. You know, I thought in recovery, if I bought all sorts of nice things, I'd feel better about myself. And then me and my nice things would be in a room, and I'd still feel shitty. And that's what it took for me. You know, I had to make mistakes, and I've made a lot of them. You know. And the nicest thing is I can learn from somebody else's today. I don't have to make them all. If somebody else makes one and shares it, I can relate to it. And maybe I won't have to go make that mistake. You know, I got into relationships too soon in recovery and got hurt. That's what it took for me to stay out of one. And I'm in one today, and it's much different than anything I've ever been in before. And I'm grateful for that. You know, I've gone through a lot of tough things in recovery. I have the disease of addiction, and through that disease, I acquired another one. And that rocked my boat for about a week, you know, because I was afraid to share it with anybody who wasn't close to me. You know, because I thought people would reject me, people would walk away from me. And when I finally copped to it in the meeting and shared it, I found the opposite. The people who were close to me got closer. A lot of people who didn't know me came into my recovery and into my life. And I have a whole other support group, you know, because there's a lot of us. And I thought I was alone in this. You know. And I was real grateful that was like a theme down at the World Convention this year to address that problem, because we're going to own it. We're going to own it more than anybody else. You know. And what are we going to do? You know, the whole topic of specialty meetings used to come up in our region. Our region, I like to think of Connecticut as a real purist type. They try to be purists. And there's a lot of us that, you know, to me, being a purist just means you attend NA. And that's it. You know, I was an addict and for a long time. You know, before I realized being an addict covered it all. And I had to learn that the drug didn't matter. You know, I had to learn the first step all over again with my other disease. I'm powerless over this. You know, but it's a gift. Everything I've gotten in recovery is a gift, and I believe that with my heart today. I needed this other disease to teach me how to take care of myself. And I take care of myself better today. You know, I think about what I'm doing all the time. When I eat, I sleep. You know, I don't stress myself out. You know, and I was always one for being an addict. Go to extremes. You know, go to conventions. Stay up in the lobby till 6 o'clock in the morning. You know, and now I go to conventions and I'm out at 11 o'clock. I'm sleeping. My alarm clock goes off at 11 o'clock. It's time to go to bed. Unless you got a real good reason to stay up. You know? Just like it says it's time to eat at noon. You know? And I've learned to really be good to myself. Because you know? I count. You know? I love myself today. I never loved myself. And by loving myself, I can love other people. I've learned that I can love everybody in this fellowship. I don't have to like them. You know, because personalities get in the way. You know. I can really dislike somebody, and he's the first one I pray for. You know. I got into service in this fellowship, I think, too soon. You know. I got dope fiend into taking a commitment that was more than I could have bargained for. Because I figured, well, I'd already done the coffee and the literature and the other things. And I said, okay, I can do everything now. And I took on a commitment and I was lost. And I felt like my sponsor was taking that commitment because I didn't know what to do. I was afraid to vote. When it came to time to vote for things, I'd have to ask and check my motives because I didn't want to self-will things. My first year in service, it's all I did was my will, you know. And by learning through that experience of being uncomfortable with myself, you know, I stuck to it. You know, and after 5 years in service, I'm retired. I'm on a sabbatical. You know, I'm giving myself a year off. I'm back to making coffee. And I'm making coffee again in my home group. Because that's the first commitment I had, and I had it for a year. And I took it again when it came up. And I figured, I said I'd take it until a newcomer wanted it. And I've had it for about a month now. And I really look forward to it. You know, it's the nicest commitment I've ever had. You know, I believe it kept me clean through my first year. And at the time when my sponsor told me to raise your hand and take that commitment, I didn't want it. I don't want to make coffee. I didn't want to pick up ashtrays. You know, I just wanted to take up space. It's not about taking up space. He said you had to participate in your own recovery. And that meant sharing. If you had nothing else to say but your name and that you were an addict, share the good stuff and the bad stuff. Because good stuff's more traumatic. I know it is for me. When I'm feeling real good, I'm in a more dangerous space than when I'm feeling real bad. Because I could get careless. I don't like to be careless. You know, recovery was a gift for me. I was lucky. I got it through the first time. You know, I ended up in the hospital, and I was scared to death. I wanted to take my life. I couldn't do it. The doctor said I was doing it the hard way. You know, I was committing suicide on the time plan, and I didn't have much farther to go. And today, I feel real grateful. I say thank you every night for another clean day. And that's about as humble as I need to be with my higher power. I ask for help and I say thank you. It's simple. I've asked for things in recovery and got them. I had to ask to have them removed. You know? And I've learned that it's not good for me to be specific. You know? I'm specific if I'm praying for somebody else. You know, if somebody's in a lot of pain, I had one of my sponsees' mother passed away a couple of weeks ago. And he was real shook up because it was unexpected and fast. And it's not the first time I've gone through death and recovery. It happens a lot. But it was the first time it was real close to me. And I didn't know what to say. know, because I don't believe there really is anything you can say, except that I'll be there, you know, and showing up. You know, I went to the wake and the funeral, and I went to his house afterwards to get him out of there, you know, because part of his family has this problem. He doesn't know what to do with it yet. And when it got real tense, I said, let's go for a drive. You know, you don't have to be here. And we talked about the relationship he had with his mother in recovery. And that was a gift that he gave her that he hadn't seen yet. And I'm grateful that I've had that opportunity with my mother. I didn't with a lot of other people in my family. And we have a real good relationship today. And sometimes that's hard. You know, my mother's in the medical field. And here I am in this predicament, as she puts it. She calls it a predicament. And she's always bouncing off all the new stuff. What do you think? And I didn't know what to think, you know. I have friends that are on different treatment plans. Some are doing well and some aren't. And for today, I just say, well, I'm glad I'm healthy. And I don't have to take anything. But I know that the day may come where I'll have to make that decision. And somebody very close to me is at that point right now. She has to make the decision. And I told her to trust her gut. Because you know, that's all we have. You know, I trust my higher power, and I've learned to trust my gut. And when I'm in doubt, I talk to a lot of people. You know, I don't limit it to one opinion. You know, I'll throw it out to all my friends. You know, it's funny, when I come through customs, Canada's the only place they don't ask when you cross the border. You know, I can't get a passport today. I can't go any place out of the United States other than here. You know, because they ask, and they don't want you. And I was real happy about that. You know, because I know today I can't give it to anybody unless I'm careless. But the governments have a problem with it, you know. And as I put it, society has a problem with it because they don't understand. But I had the same problem years ago. I had the same problem with it because I didn't understand. And maybe that's why I got the gift, so I would, you know. But I know today when I need help, it's easy. I don't beat myself up. I ask. And when I'm in a real bad place, I let everybody know that. My friends know it right away. I can walk into the room and they say, what's wrong? And I'm grateful for that. Because as an addict, I was an isolationist. I spent 3 years living in a cabin in Maine by myself. And I loved it. I thought, you know, the sick part of me would do that again today. I look at the countryside up here. Give me a log cabin on a lake with no roads. My addiction would move right in. But how long would I last by myself? I've been in a place where I started out going to 7 or more meetings a week. I'm still in that place. I still go every day. And I don't know why anybody wouldn't. I always feel better. I've never been to a meeting where I came out of it feeling worse. You know, come out of them crying because of something I heard. Or somebody was in a lot of pain. But I still felt better because I could feel it. And recovery's given me that ability. You know, I can feel somebody else's pain. You know, I can feel their joy. I can see their happiness. And it's helped me become a better me, I guess. So, in closing, closing, I want to thank you for asking me. And I want to thank you all for being here. You know, because without you, I'm alone and then I'm in trouble. So, thanks.